Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Today we're listening to a speech by Dr. Steven Bezruchka. He's the director of the Population Health Forum at the University of Washington. The speech was given on February 9th, 2004 at Seattle University. Dr. Bezruchka is addressing the connection between social justice and health outcomes. Dr. Bezruchka is introduced by Dean Walker of the Seattle School of Nursing.
It's a pleasure to be sitting here with the opportunity to present to you Dr. Steven Bezruchka. He has concentrated his international work in Nepal, where he first spent a year learning the local language before going to Stanford Medical School. In the 1970s, back when actually I was in nursing school, which seems longer ago than I care to recall, he set up a community health project in a remote Himalayan valley, where he trained local healthcare workers and set up community liaisons to coordinate five clinics in local villages. Under using patient retained records. He then set up a remote district hospital as a teaching hospital for Nepalese fledgling family practice residencies and supervised the first doctors rotating there. He has consulted on child survival, HIV, and safer motherhood projects there. With a Nepali surgeon, he has set up Scalpel, which links Kathmandu-based surgeons with medical officers posted to rural hospitals and operates workshops to assist the doctors in carrying out needed surgery and anesthesia in situ. Currently, he teaches in the International Health Program at the School of Public Health and Community Medicine at the University of Washington and is interested in broad-based dissemination of information on the income-equity-health relationship. And notice that's health and not health care. Dr. Bezruchka has indicated that he will confine his remarks today to four points. The first, we are in the U.S., and yet we are the least healthy of people in about 25 other countries, no matter what measure of health is used, and we pay the ultimate price for living here. We die younger than we need to. Point number two, we used to be a much healthier country compared to others, and our health relative to other countries has declined in the last 50 to 55 years. Point number three, the reason for this health decline has been the changing socioeconomic structure of this country in deciding who gets what share of the pie, where the pie can be construed as wealth, income, status, class, or resource pastry. And finally, if we want to regain our health and not die young, we need to return to the caring and sharing values that were in place in America when we were one of the healthiest nations on the planet. Dr. Bezruchka indicates that he hopes that this will generate considerable discussion from the guests and the students and attendees at this meeting. And without further ado, I present to you Dr. Steven Bezruchka.
Thank you. I suppose I would prefer to stand so that I can see all of you and you can see me. But first I have to report that I've just been handed a late news-breaking bulletin. The weapons of mass destruction have been found. They've been located. This is wonderful news. Now, I have to wait for my operative to gain clearance for me to divulge the location of the weapons of mass destruction. I have to get security clearance from the Department of Homeland Security, so bear with me. In the meantime, the dean has already made my 4 points, and so let me continue by asking, how did I come to think of these thoughts? Now, in an institution like Seattle University, I think we can talk about epistemology. How do people come to hold beliefs and thoughts and ideas? Well, among the reasons you can reflect on, it might have been what you were taught in school. It might have been ideas or thoughts or information that your parents had. It might have a lot to do with what you experience. Or it can have a lot to do with your thoughts and reflections on important ideas. So, how did I come to consider these 4 points? Well, one thing was, at an early age, I was interested in becoming a doctor, and I think some of that had to do with my brother who died when I was 2 and he was 4. And I was socialized into thinking of the importance of seeing a doctor in medical care for that reason. At that time, I didn't think much about what produced health, but I assumed that the usual advice that we're all given, not to smoke, to eat right, to exercise, not shoot up, and wear my seatbelt, that was what produced health. I then became interested in abstract concepts of mathematics and physics, and eventually wound up at Harvard University studying for a PhD in mathematics. But I became disillusioned because those concepts really weren't very useful, and I decided I wanted to do something more useful. So I went back to thinking about becoming a doctor, and when I went to medical school almost 35 years ago, at that time, I was surprised to learn that compared to other countries, the United States was less healthy than about 13 or 14 or 15 of them. I mentioned this to my students and faculty, and nobody seemed to be very interested in the subject. And I also said, I'm not sure that medical care has much to do with this, and they didn't respond to that either. And then, as was pointed out, I managed to work in this remote valley in Nepal, providing medical services or teaching local people to do so in an area that had no medical services. And I was quite surprised that once people survived childhood, they seemed to live pretty healthy lives. And one of the things I also began to notice there was that the people who got sick tended to be poor people. Now, if you went there and you looked at the people, you'd think everybody was poor. But because I lived in that society, I could tell the class and status and caste differences. And it really was the people in the bottom end of the spectrum that got sick. I then came back to the United States, where I've continued to work as an ER doc. And one of the things that I reflected on my experiences working as an ER doc, whether it was over in Bellevue, where some of the richest people in the world lived, or down in Tacoma General, in a poor area of town, or just over the hill here at Providence, as I reflected on the patients that I saw, they tended to be poor. Now, I used to think back 20 years ago that the poor people in this country were sort of taking advantage of welfare. And, you know, we used to sort of bitch among the other nurses and doctors about this. And I also found myself blaming my patients for their behaviors that were responsible for their illnesses. At the same time, I looked at these comparative health statistics, and I found that the health of the United States, of us in this country, compared to other countries, continued to drop. And I also found another country whose health status continued to rise, so that by 1978, it was the healthiest country in the world. And I didn't have a clue why. What really startled me was to learn that the healthiest country in the world smoked the most of all rich countries. That really bothered me. And also, all the healthier countries than the United States had a much less technologically advanced or sophisticated healthcare system. So about 12 years ago, I went back to school to Johns Hopkins University with this question in mind: what made a population healthy? And I knew it wasn't medical care, but I really didn't know what produced health in a population. Well, when I got there, what I found was people really weren't interested in that question. This was 1992, and so people were mostly interested in Hillary Clinton's reforms of the healthcare system. Yes, everybody, when I questioned them, would admit, yeah, healthcare doesn't have much to do with health. But meanwhile, here are all these reforms going on, and we have to sort of put our fingers into the pot of gold that we see in front of us. Since then, of course, our health compared to other countries has continued to decline. So I've had to learn about what makes a population healthy on my own. And I think that this is a critical concept for anything really important in your life. If it's really important to you, you have to figure it out for yourself. You can't rely on others and their ideas. You have to figure it out yourself. And so this is true for almost anything. You know, right going back in the beginning, when you think about one and one, does it equal two? You get one thing and then another thing when you put them together, and yes, it's two. I can observe it. It makes sense. And you can verify it. So that is how I approach health. It has to make sense, and I have to be able to verify it. So I make these four points that were made for me by reflecting on life's experiences, by reading and discussion with various people who have expertise, and by discussing with people who disagree with me. And I think that's critical. You want to hear opposing points of view and try and understand their perspective and your perspective and see what you can learn from it.
Today we're listening to a speech by Dr. Stephen Bezruchka. He's the director of the Population Health Forum at the University of Washington. The speech was given on February 9th, 2004 at Seattle University.
So how do I consider other interpretations on a subject? Well, as a scientist, I don't want to get caught with egg on my face. And for almost any issue that you think about, there are many perspectives. And every concept pretty well has a totally opposing point of view. For example, the Flat Earth Society still exists. But on the basis of my flying around the world a few times, I tend to not give the Flat Earth Society much credence. But I can live on a flat Earth. At least it wouldn't change anything that I do on a day-to-day basis or have done. It doesn't bother me a bit. But it does bother me that our health as a nation is so far behind that of the other rich countries, and we all die younger for being in this country. So when I say that an idea or a concept is important, I look at what others say. And one of the wonderful things about technology these days is you can do citation searches very, very easily. In other words, you take a concept in an academic paper or a magazine article or a book, and you can go to the computer and find all the citations of that article or book. And so you can reflect on what other people have said. Another thing I do, as I said, is I talk to other people. If they're alive, I cross the ocean or cross the continent to go meet with them and try and get a sense of who are these people expressing these ideas. If they're dead or in prison, I read their memoirs or meet people who know them. If I can, I listen to speeches. Because when you're thinking of ideas that are really important, you have to reflect on, is this plausible? Another thing I do is I pose questions to my students. I teach at the University of Washington in our School of Public Health, and we have a really exciting program for a master's degree in public health in which students do not take courses. They meet in small groups and address problems. And each week they have a different problem. And I've been fortunate to create the first month's problems for the entering students. And the first problem that the students face is very simple. You're a speechwriter for the president. The president wants to make a speech about how America is the healthiest country in the world. Your job is to write the speech. That's the first problem. So another thing I do is express my ideas in public and ponder the reaction. Hear arguments, lock horns, so to speak, and that's what I hope that we can accomplish here today. Now, I announced the weapons of mass destruction had been located. Now, what was the evidence that was presented on the weapons of mass destruction a year ago? What kind of evidence was it? Was it made explicit? Now that we've found the evidence for the existence of the weapons of mass destruction, let's go on to the evidence for the four points that I made. Anything I say, any points I will raise, I have a lot of supporting documentation for, some of which is on the references on the back of the handout, and other references are at our Population Health Forum's website at the University of Washington, and the URL is there as well. And so none of the points I'm going to make are going to be found in secret CIA files or anywhere else like that. It's all pretty open. So the first point is we are less healthy than people in the other rich countries. And as I said, I challenge my students to come up with some definition of health, some concept of health in which the United States is number one, and they can't do so. Now, if you go, so how are we going to evaluate this? Well, let's go to our federal bodies. This is the Institute of Medicine's report produced last year. It's entitled The Future of the Public's Health in the 21st Century. And if we go to page 20, it is written, quote, "For years, the life expectancies of both men and women in the United States have lagged behind those of their counterparts in most other industrialized nations. In the area of chronic disease, reported incidence rates in 1990 for all cancers in males and females were highest in the U.S. among a group of 30 industrialized nations." This is what our federal body says. And anywhere else you go, when you make comparisons of our health compared to people in other countries, we don't do so well. So who are these countries that are healthier than we are? Well, to begin with, they're pretty well all the other rich countries, and a few poor ones as well. Costa Rica, Cyprus, Malta, Israel, Greece, and so on. We're about as healthy as Cuba. Cuba's the country we've been strangling for 45 years. Think of it. We've been making Cubans' lives as miserable as possible, and they're as healthy as we are. Now, last month I was in Nepal, and I spent an afternoon talking with the people in the health section of the United States Agency for International Development about these ideas. And one astute lady there asked, "Is Cuba as healthy as we are because of or in spite of the sanctions?" I ask you to reflect on that. Now, you might say, I don't care about life expectancy. I care about quality of life rather than living long. But there's no measure of health, including all the quality of life measures, in which we compare well with other countries. For example, among other rich countries, we have the highest infant mortality rate, the highest homicide rate, the highest teenage birth rate, the highest incarceration rate. For example, we house a quarter of the world's prisoners. We have the highest child poverty rate, the highest child abuse death rate, the highest child injury death rate, and the greatest gap in mortality within parts of this country for all nations for which we have data. Now, all of these are kind of health-related measures. But we could also look at more broadly among nations for things that are not so obviously related to health. So among the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the 30 richest countries, we have one of the lowest educational achievement scores at the high school level, the highest number of people living alone, the highest poverty rate, arguably the largest number of homeless and homeless children, and the highest rates of those, and certainly the biggest gap between the rich and the poor. We also have the fewest number of people making the transition from being poor to middle class, and we have the smallest middle class. I can go on and on, but I'll spare you. But let me point out that if we cured heart disease in the United States, suppose we won the war on heart disease, we still wouldn't be the healthiest country in the world. Now, heart disease is going to kill almost half of you in this room. It's our leading cause of death. And as a doctor who's been treating heart disease for 30 years, to suggest to my fellow doctors that we could cure heart disease, they would consider to be clinically impossible. But this is how far behind we are in health. The second point is that this represents a decline over the last 55 years. Again, no question about this. If we go back to the future of the public health in the 21st century quote that I read you, they said, for years, life expectancy in the U.S. has lagged behind. That's a clear reference to the fact that we used to be better off in the past. And again, the scientific literature here is solid. There is no debate. There is no debate on this, I don't think, but maybe. But so far, I think if you look at the literature, nobody can disagree with either the first or the second point. Now I come to the reason for this health decline. And what I say, it has to do with changing the structure in this society, changing the rules for who gets what share of the pie. Now, once again, our federal bodies are quite explicit. If we go to our Institute of Medicine report, we will find on page 59, quote, more egalitarian societies, i.e. those with a less steep differential between the richest and the poorest, have better average health, end of quote. Let me read that again. More egalitarian societies, i.e. those with a less steep differential between the richest and the poorest, have better average health, end of quote. The feds know this. It's very clearly stated. We could end there, and as you know, I've verified my point with authority. But let me interpret this concept further for you. Now, there's lots of data, studies, that demonstrate that egalitarian societies are healthier. We have statistical evidence on populations. We have multi-level studies looking at individual and societal data. Now, you might say, well, there's lies, damned lies, and statistics. And you can make the argument for the earth being flat with those. I also hear public health students sometimes saying, a good epidemiologist can tear any argument apart. So the skeptics want to get me in the den with the epidemiology lions, and I'm happy to do that. But I want to address one point now that I hope you're all wondering about, that I touched on at the beginning when I discussed coming to this relationship, and that has to do with healthcare. There's no uniform relationship between health and healthcare. The two are different concepts. We conflate health and healthcare. Thomas Pynchon wrote in Gravity's Rainbow, if they can get you asking the wrong question, the answers don't matter. And mostly in the United States, we talk about healthcare when we mean health, and we ask questions about healthcare when we should be asking questions about health. Well, I could talk at great length about how healthcare doesn't have a lot to do with health, but once again, let's go to an authoritative quote, the Oxford Textbook of Public Health. It's a large three-volume tome. I didn't bring the library's copy, but in the 2002 edition in volume 1, page 238, in the chapter on medical care and health, in the conclusion it states, the impact of personal medical services on the health and survival of individuals seems readily apparent. Surprisingly, it is more difficult to demonstrate conclusively the impact of these medical advances on the health of whole communities, end of quote. In other words, there's really no convincing evidence that medical care benefits whole populations. If there was, you would think that we would be healthier, since we spend half of the world's health care bill here in the United States, and we don't have a lot to show for it. I must also admit that I find people much believe the idea that health and health care are quite different concepts in other countries, much more than they do in the United States.
Today we're listening to a speech by Dr. Stephen Bezruchka. He's the director of the Population Health Forum at the University of Washington. The speech was given on February 9th, 2004 at Seattle University.
Now, if you're having trouble seeing that the role of medical care is not one of producing healthy populations, let me make another analogy. The healthcare establishment is like the Army Medical Corps. The Army Medical Corps did not decide whether we would invade Iraq or not. They didn't decide the daily battle strategies. They didn't decide whether we would bomb from the air or send in ground forces. They didn't decide on the protective gear for the troops, and they didn't decide on the ordnance. What did they do? After the bomb, the blast, or the bullets, when most people who are going to die have already died, they come in and they find a few people who still have signs of life. What do? They start IVs, splint limbs, established airways, and evacuate these people to field hospitals where blood is transfused, the bullet holes are sewn up, and then they're evacuated to rehabilitation centers where prosthetic limbs are fitted and people relearn the activities of daily living and are reintegrated into American society. That's the best that we can hope for from healthcare. It's like the Army Medical Corps. If the Army Medical Corps could decide whether to invade or not, then we could save an awful lot more lives. So, more egalitarian societies, those with a smaller gap between the rich and the poorest, have better average health, so the feds state. So what I've learned, poorer people have poorer health, and the amount that poorer people's health is worse depends on the gap between the rich and the poor in that society. Now, you know, the Fed said this, we're talking about average health. And averages, of course, hide individual exceptions. You know, there's the tragic case of Princess Diana, who died young and certainly was not poor. And then there was old Grandma Moses, who was poor and died at 101, and she was still painting when she died. So there are going to be exceptions to everything. But on a population basis, we're talking about averages. And as I said, one of the ways in which I came to hold these ideas by considering the work I did in emergency rooms. When I worked at Overlake, I saw poor people. When I worked at Providence, I saw poor people. When I worked at Tacoma General, I saw poor people. Is that because the rich have their own doctors? No, the rich don't get sick as much. They don't die as often. All the studies show that. I also used to think it was individual behaviors that mattered in producing health. Whether you smoked, what you ate, whether you exercised, wore your seatbelt, wore a condom, that sort of thing. The usual stuff I used to preach to my patients. I used to even get complaints from patients' families because I would harp on, a person who has emphysema, chronic lung disease, and I tell them, look, you just got to quit smoking. There's nothing else we can do. And the family would say, can't you do something? He's trying to quit, but he can't. Well, you know, I don't talk about that these days. I still continue to work as an ER doc. I was at group health on Friday night. But when I came to realize that Japan, the healthiest country in the world, has the most smokers among all rich countries, I had to abandon my beliefs that it was personal behaviors that really produced health. So think of it. There are twice as many Japanese men smoking in Japan than American men smoking in the U.S. Yet their smoking-attributable death rates, the deaths due to smoking in Japan, are half of ours. They smoke twice as much and pay half the price. Well, maybe that's the reason Japan's so healthy. They smoke so much. Maybe we should all go up and smoke. Right? Well, no. On average, a smoker is going to be less healthy than a non-smoker. But there must be something more important in producing health than behaviors that we would consider bad, such as smoking. Well, the Institute of Medicine said explicitly that countries with a smaller gap between the rich and the poor should have better average health. Is that true in Japan? Well, how do we measure the gap between the rich and the poor? Economists and sociologists use many different measures. Perhaps the simplest one is to think of the CEO average worker pay gap. What does the CEO make as a proportion of the number of the salary of the average worker? And for a data source, let's go to two Sundays ago, New York Times, in the business section. And there they have listed the CEO average worker pay gap in the United States as 531-1. That is, a boss in America makes on average 531 times what an average worker makes. And there they also said the CEO pay gap in Japan is 10 to 1. So American bosses make 53 times as much as Japanese bosses do compared to the average worker. Sorry to get so quantitative, but I think you have to look at a few numbers. Now, I'm sure most of you will agree that people in this country get paid enormous sums. And most of you may not be aware of just how much they get paid. What is the highest wage in this country right now? Well, in 2002, it was $150,000 an hour. Nice work if you can get it, and as Cole Porter says. And in this country, we believe you can get it if you try. The minimum wage is $6.01 an hour in this state. So that's about a 25,000-fold difference. Now, once again, this is an extreme, and averages hide those extremes. But the average in the United States, 531-1, is pretty odious at best. Now, 55 years ago, the United States was one of the healthiest countries in the world. No doubt about that. And the pay gap, as you will understand, was much less. It's been kept on rising. By 1980, it was only 40-1, however. And last year, according to the New York Times, it was 531-1, the highest recorded in any society. So how would a small gap between the rich and the poor improve average health? Well, think about a small gap society, an egalitarian society. What would the prevailing relationships there be? Wouldn't they be those of friendship, sociability, support, respect, trust, cooperation? Don't they sound like healthy words, healthy feelings, healthy relationships? What about a hierarchical society, a big gap society? What are the prevailing relationships and feelings? Well, think of it. Those on top have power. They dominate. They coerce people to get things done. The rest of us have to resign ourselves to our fate, feel humiliated, and feel resentment and feel shamed. And I think shame is the ultimate emotion prevailing in a big gap society. And none of those terms sound healthy, do they? Well, how would you decide whether the points I've just presented, the statistical relationship and these factors, are causal or not? Remember, just because you have an association doesn't mean it's causal. You know, just because we can fly around the Earth and we can see it as a disk from outer space does not prove that the Earth is a sphere. Now, the Surgeon General's report in 1964 on smoking and health outlined how we should look at data to infer causality. And they use something called the Bradford Hill criteria, which epidemiologists talk about. And there are four points in the Bradford Hill criteria that fit the situation here. Namely, we have to have consistency. That is, many studies on many different populations by different investigators over different time periods showing the same thing. And you can search through the references there and find those. The second thing is a dose-response relationship. More inequality leads to worse health. And that's been verified many times, too. The next thing is the direction of causation. Do people become sick and then become poor, or is it the poor that become sick? And when you study that, you find consistently it is the poor that become sick. Finally, there has to be, according to the Surgeon General, biologic plausibility. There has to be some evidence in biology, in pathophysiology, that helps us understand that.
You've been listening to the first half of a speech by Dr. Stephen Bezruchka, the Director of Population Health Forum at the University of Washington. Check back next week for the second half of the speech and an interview that I conducted with Dr. Bezruchka. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.